All righty. Well, good morning. How are we doing? Are we waking up? Did we get our morning coffee?
No.
Not here. Well, I heard Greg Coco was here last week. He normally says, you know, before my first cup of coffee in the morning, I'm an atheist. I have one cup, I turn into a Jehovah's Witness, and then one more cup, and I'm back to a Christian. You know, my thinking isn't right. So hopefully some of us are not in that place. We've moved on, and we're still Christians here this morning. My name is Ryan Pauley. I have the awesome privilege to talk to you guys this morning about how relativism undermines your students' faith. And how many of you are student pastors, work with students? Okay, a few other camp counselors? All righty. Well, I think this is a huge issue, right? I'm a high school teacher. I teach Christian doctrine, apologetics, comparative religions and worldviews and ethics to high schoolers, 10th through 12th grade. And one thing I constantly hear is students coming up and saying, you know, I've talked to my friends, and they say things like, well, that's true for you, but not for me. We talk about the topic of homosexuality in my class, and they go, well, you know, my friend is gay or lesbian. And they think it's fine. And are you going to say that it's wrong? And are you really going to say Jesus is the only way? Look, Mr. Pauley, we study world religions. There's tons of people out there believing different stuff. And so we have these ideas in our culture that are causing our students to think and to question the very basics of Christianity. And so we want to spend a little bit of time this morning and discuss this idea of what is relativism and then how it is undermining our students' faith in Christ, some of the effects that we see of it in culture, and then hopefully then give some practical ways and how can we as youth workers respond in order to help our students. Because I think, I can probably guess that our goal of every person here this morning is that when we work with students, that we are developing students who become lifelong followers of Jesus Christ, right? What we're seeing in the church is almost the opposite. Right? Depending on the study you look at, 60 to 80% of students leave the church after high school. That is heartbreaking. I met a pastor once, a good friend of mine. I shouldn't say I met him once. He's a good friend of mine. I met him lots of times. And he worked in junior high ministry. And the first time he had a group of students go through his ministry, then go through high school ministry, they got to college and they all left the church. And he just went, what am I doing? What am I doing? Something is not working. Something has to change. And so he made changes. But what we see in our culture is this idea of relativism. And this is all based on the idea of trying to understand what truth is. And so there's two different views of truth. And I don't know where we're at this morning. So we're going to kind of do a quick introduction. But our first kind of truth is a subjective truth or relative truth. And a good way to think about this is if you're thinking about your favorite kind of ice cream. This is a truth that's based on the subject, the individual, the person, and it's based on their beliefs or their thoughts or their opinions, right? So if I come up here and I say, you know, coffee ice cream is the best ice cream, how many of you disagree? Well, you guys are all wrong. Well, no, you don't say that. Why? Because when I say coffee ice cream is the best, that's just my... Do we need more coffee this morning? That's just my opinion, right? We have our opinions about our favorite sports teams. We have our opinions about our favorite food. We have our opinions about everything. And I'm not going to say my opinion is necessarily better than someone else's. It's just our opinion. So this is one type of truth, is a subjective truth. However, another kind of truth that we have is objective truth. And when you think of this, you can kind of think of medicine. Right, no one breaks their arm with the bone sticking out of the skin, goes to the doctor, he takes x-rays and says, your arm is broken, and you go, doctor, that's just your opinion. No, right? We don't say that to the doctor, right? Because we understand this is an objective truth. An objective truth is something that is true for all people at all times and all places, whether you believe it or not. This morning, I'm going to be talking with the students on how Jesus is the only way, and I'm going to be sharing a story of when I had appendicitis. And in the morning, I woke up with this terrible pain in my stomach, but it wasn't extreme. It was, you know, wasn't at that level that it got to later in the day, and I thought, man, I think I have a stomach ache. And so I ate some food, thinking maybe I'm just hungry. My belief was that I was just hungry, and that's why my stomach hurt. Well, I quickly found out my belief was wrong. It wasn't that I was hungry. It wasn't just a simple stomach ache. I had appendicitis that required surgery. I can ignore that belief, and it doesn't change it, right? I can ignore it. I can think, it's just a stomachache. I believe it's just a stomachache. It's just a stomachache. It doesn't make it go away. It doesn't change the fact that I had appendicitis. And this would be an objective truth. But what we see in our culture is we're seeing a change where all truth is becoming subjective. All truth is becoming relative. And especially when it comes to religious truth, right? And so we maybe find some people that say, well, you know, things like medicine, that is objectively true. And things like math and science, that is objectively true. But when it comes to religious beliefs, not religious truths, that's just relative. That's true for you, but that's not true for me, right? And so we have this idea that people come along and say, well, you know, there is no truth. What our students don't understand is that this very idea of relativism in our culture is self-defeating. Because the statement, there is no truth, if you ask a question back, you could ask the person that says, hey, there is no truth. Well, is that true? Is it true that there is no truth? Because if it's true that there is no truth, then there's truth. But if it's not true that there is no truth, then there is truth. Are you following me this morning? No, it's early. The very idea of saying there is no truth, the person has to make a truth statement. But then they might say, well, no, okay, no, there is truth in science and math and that sort of stuff, but there is no religious truth. Well, is that a religious truth? Because you're trying to make a claim about religion, and you're trying to make me believe that that is actually true. But a lot of times our students don't know how to ask sometimes these simple questions. This is one of the main things I teach my students, is just responding with questions, trying to help the other person kind of see clearly. And so we need to help our students understand this. And so what we come to, and another form of this moral relativism, and even a relativistic truth in our society, is this idea called deconstructionism. And deconstructionism is where the reader's interpretation is more important than the author's intent. That words don't have meaning from the author, and that we can read our own meaning into something. And sadly, this has crept into the church and into Christianity. How many Bible studies do we go to where you hear the question, what does this verse mean to me? Now, I think sometimes the person just saying, you know, how can I apply this to my life? But I often hear it from students saying, you know, what does this mean to me? What is my meaning for this verse? Rather than when we are reading God's word, we are trying to say, what is God trying to say to me? What is God's objective meaning? What is his intention? What is his desire? What is his meaning? And then what is that? Then how do I apply that to my life? Where oftentimes we see people and we read it and say, you know, what does this mean to me? And we create our own subjective meaning and go, yeah, I like that. And we see that happening all the time, right? We see this happening in lots of different forms of Reformation theology and stuff in our culture where people are trying to reinterpret scripture to get it to say what they want it to say, right? We take verses out of context. We see this in like I said, the Reformation Project, this movement of gay Christianity, where they're reinterpreting the New Testament to show that it's actually gay-affirming, and our students are falling for it. I had students come to me last summer saying, but look, boom, 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 and they lay out this case that the New Testament is gay-affirming. It's because people, rather than trying to understand the original meaning, they read their own interpretation and they can change it based on the culture that we live in today. And so meaning is just based on culture and where we're at. And so this is the first thing I think our students have to understand when we're talking about this relativism in culture, is getting this idea that there is objective truth. There are some things that are true for all people in all times, whether you believe it or not, whether it makes you feel good or not. And that it's not just our interpretation of reality, but we should be searching for what is true and then allowing our beliefs to match reality. Second thing I think our students need to understand is this idea, which is the law of non-contradiction. It states that contradictory statements cannot both be true at the same time and in the same sense. Now, the technical way of writing this out is A is B and A is not B are mutually exclusive. A different way of putting this is saying, to say that the earth is round and the earth is not round cannot both be true at the same time and in the same way. Now, the law of non-contradiction doesn't help us discover what's true, but once we know what's true, then it helps us know what is false. If we know that the earth is round, then any statement contradicting that, saying the earth is a triangle, the earth is a square, the earth is whatever, is going to be false, because they both cannot be true in the same time and in the same sense. And even to try and deny the law of non-contradiction, you have to affirm it. So these are laws of logic that we can't get around. This is also something that our relativism in culture is ignoring, is cultural relativism. Now, how does this apply to our faith? Well, here's another statement. Jesus is God, and Jesus is not God. This is what we see in our culture, where students are saying, you know, Jesus is God. Someone comes along and says, Jesus is not God. Can they both be true? Can he be God and not God at the same time? No. Can God exist and not exist at the same time? No. But you wouldn't believe how many students I have tell me, oh yeah, God's existence is solely based on your belief. If you believe he exists, he exists. If you believe he doesn't, he doesn't. Well, can we apply the same logic to my laptop sitting right here? If I just believe it's not here, does it just disappear? Well, no, my belief would be wrong, right? My belief is wrong if I'm going to believe that my laptop is not here. It doesn't just disappear based on what I believe about it. In the same way, God does not appear or disappear based on our belief about him. So this is a statement in our culture. Some people saying Jesus is not God. Some people say he is. They both can't be true at the same time and in the same sense. And so this idea of relativism is undermining the very core of Christianity. John 14:6, Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Here's the problem, guys. If Jesus claims to be the truth, but there is no truth, then how is he the truth? He claims to be the way, not a way, like our relativistic culture is teaching our students. All right, so this makes two huge statements. He's the way, the truth, the life. He is the thing. This is the objective truth. This is who Jesus is. And our relativism is saying, well, no, that's just if you believe it. But I don't believe he's the way. And so my belief is right too, because I believe it. He says, no one comes to the Father except through me if that's what you believe. No, right? So here Jesus is making an objective statement. I am the only way. Any other way, therefore, that contradicts me, that goes against me, is false. And so here's the very core of how relativism is undermining our students' faith in Jesus Christ. If they start to accept this idea where truth becomes relative, then Jesus can't be the truth. Now I want to show you a video and kind of see the extreme that this is playing out in our culture today. And I want you to, as you watch it, look for some of the statements that the students here are making and kind of what is it that stands out to you in some of the things that they're saying. So watch this short video.
But how far does it go? And is it possible to be wrong? We went to the University of Washington to find out.
Are you aware of the debate happening in Washington State around the ability to access bathrooms, locker rooms, spas based on gender identity and gender expression?
I think people should be able to have access to the facility.
I think bathrooms could and potentially should be gender neutral because there doesn't need to be a classification for differences.
I think people definitely should have the ability to go into whichever locker room they want.
I feel like at least public universities should do their best to accommodate for those who do not have a specific gender identity.
You know, whether you identify as male or female and whether your sex at birth is matching to that, you should be able to utilize the resources.
So if I told you that I was a woman, what would your response be?
Good for you. Okay. Like, yeah.
Nice to meet you.
I'd be like, what? Really?
I don't have a problem with it.
I'd ask you how you came to that conclusion.
if I told you that I was Chinese, what would your response be?
I mean, I might be a little surprised, but I would say, good for you. Like, yeah, be who you are.
I would maybe think you had some Chinese ancestor.
I would ask you how you similarly came to that conclusion and why you came to that conclusion.
I would have a lot of questions, just because on the outside, I would assume that you're a white man.
If I told you that I was 7 years old, what would your response be?
I wouldn't believe that immediately.
I probably wouldn't believe it, but I mean, it wouldn't really bother me that much to go out of my way and tell you, no, you're wrong. I'd just be like, oh, okay, he wants to say he's 7 years old.
If you feel seven at heart, then then so be it. Yeah, good for you.
So if I wanted to enroll in a first grade class, do you think I should be allowed to?
Probably not, I guess. I mean, unless you haven't completed first grade up to this point and for some reason need to do that now.
If that's where you feel like mentally you should be, then I feel like there are communities that would accept you for that.
I would say so long as you're not hindering society and you're not causing harm to other people, I feel like that should be a okay thing.
If I told you I'm 6'5", what would you say?
That I would question.
Why?
Because you're not. No, I don't think you're 6'5".
If you truly believed you're 6'5", I don't think it's harmful. I think it's fine if you believe that. It doesn't matter to me if you think you're taller than you are.
So you'd be willing to tell me I'm wrong?
I wouldn't tell you you're wrong.
No, but I say that I don't think that you are.
I feel like that's not my place as like another human to say someone is wrong or to draw lines or boundaries.
No, I mean, I wouldn't just go like, oh, you're wrong. Like, that's wrong to believe in it. Because, I mean, again, it doesn't really bother me what you want to think about your height or anything.
So I can be a Chinese woman.
You. Sure.
But I can't be a 6'5" Chinese woman.
Yes.
If you thoroughly debated me or explained why you felt that you were 6'5", I feel like I would be very open to saying that you are 6'5", or Chinese, or a woman.
It shouldn't be hard to tell a 5'9 white guy that he's not a 6'5" Chinese woman. But clearly it is. Why? What does that say about our culture? And what does that say about our ability to answer the questions that actually are difficult?
I like that. If you stand for nothing, you fall for anything. What does this say about our culture? What do you guys think? Stupid. Were there any kind of sayings that something the student said that really kind of stuck out to you? That was like, wow, I can't believe they said something like that. Yeah. Yeah, it's not my place as another human being to tell you that you're wrong. We're living in a culture that says humans can't tell other humans that they're wrong. Now my question is, these students are at the university. Has their professor ever told them you got the wrong answer? Do they expect their professors to give them, say, good job and pat them on the back every single time? Now that's kind of a culture we live in, right? Kind of the everybody gets the trophy, everyone is a winner kind of culture. I remember being in high school and we lost a game. It was basketball. We lost a game by like, I don't know, like 30 points or something. You know, we got destroyed. My mom came up and said, good game. And, you know, I finally went, Mom, were you watching the same game that I just played in? And she quickly realized, you know, I don't want to just hear a good job pat on the back when I didn't do good. We didn't play well. Let's actually speak the truth of what actually happened, right? And, but that's something, yeah, that we live in. We can't tell someone else that they're wrong. Is there anything else that stood out to you guys? What they said? Yeah.
Well, if that's what you believe, then good for you.
Yeah, if that's what you believe, good for you. If you want to believe it, as long as you're not hurting anyone. Well, this is an important question, because when does it actually start to hurt someone? Because here's the thing, ideas have consequences, and bad ideas can cause serious problems. And we've seen this throughout our culture. I was just listening to someone talking on the podcast, Brett Kunkel, another speaker at Student Reason. This is something that he said. Ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have victims. There are worldviews, there are ideas that cause harm to people. And I'm going to show you a video here in a little bit, and we're going to talk about kind of what is some logical conclusions that we can draw of where are we going to stop when it comes to this idea. Now, I'm a high school teacher. I think it's true. You don't just walk up to someone and say, you're wrong, and be a jerk about it. When I get back my tests, I don't laugh at my students and make fun of them and, hey, everybody, look how many they missed. They got so many wrong. No. Right? There's a loving and there's a compassionate way. And as we'll see here in a little bit, I think that the loving thing to do is to give the person the truth. To withhold the truth is actually unloving. We're going to get there in a little bit. Now, you say, well, maybe these are just some non-Christian students from, you know, the University of Washington. Is this really affecting our students? Absolutely, this is affecting Christian students. The Barna Research Group just teamed up with Summit Ministries back in March, the beginning of this year, and did a study on Christian worldview. And what they found is that only 17% of Christians, and these are Christians that say they take their faith seriously, they go to church every week, have a Christian worldview. 17%. Now, this is not just students either. This is students and adults. And here's what they found. At least 61% of practicing Christians embrace at least one of the ideas rooted in spirituality. Now, I don't know how much you can see this, but if you notice at the bottom, there's an under 45 and an over 45. And in each one of these stats I'm going to show you, the under 45 is extremely higher, always. How relativism is influencing our students higher than the older generation. Here, 33% of young Christians under 45 years old say that all people pray to the same God, they just have different names for him. So the Muslims praying to Allah, the Buddhists praying to Buddha, the Hindus praying to Krishna, the Christians praying to Jesus, it's all the same God, we just call him a different name. Everyone believes, 33% of young Christians. We also see meaning and purpose come from becoming one with all there is. 38% of Christians under 45. Meaning and purpose is becoming one. It's an idea rooted in this new age, new spirituality movement. If you do good, good you receive good. If you do bad, you receive bad. This idea of karma, 50% of young Christians are believing in karma, in how they believe that morality and ethics is kind of played out in our society. This is huge. Well, we can move on to other worldviews, secularist worldview. Researchers found 29% of practicing Christians believe in at least one aspect of secularism. And this is all, I can give you a link to this. This is all online at the Barna's website. But here it is. 25% of Christians under the age of 45 believe that truth has to be proven by science in order to be true. If it's not proven by science, then it's not true. It's just your belief. It's not a scientific truth. Religion, maybe God's existence, hasn't been proven by science. And so there we go. It can't be true for all people. A person's life is only valuable if society sees it as valuable. 28% of young Christians line up with that one. Now, where does this come into play? The topic of abortion. With the topic, the end of life. California and Colorado just passed the end of life where now you can do physician-assisted suicide. If you don't see your life as valuable, if society doesn't see your life as valuable, if you're just an unborn, you're just a clump of cells, I don't see you as valuable, then we can kill you. And here, 28% of young Christians are agreeing with this idea that is rooted in the secular worldview. Now, the topic of our discussion today is the postmodern worldview, this idea of relativism. As a whole, more than half, 54% of practicing Christians embrace at least one of the postmodern statements addressed in the research. And again, notice how high the under 45 is. No one can know for certain the meaning and purpose there is to life. 32% of young Christians. No one can know the meaning and purpose. 32%. This one I think is even more scary. 37% of Christians under 45 believe that morality is right or wrong depending on what an individual believes. If you believe that what you're doing is fine, it's fine. Maybe my parents are against me drinking underage, but if I believe it's okay, I can go do it. My church is against premarital sex, but all my friends and I think it's fine, so I'm gonna do it because morality is based on what I believe. And hey, if your beliefs offend someone or hurt their feelings, then your belief is, can you see that? It's wrong. So if you're gonna say something that offends someone, then you are wrong. 29% of young Christians. Well, the sad thing is the gospel is offensive, right? The gospel tells us that we are broken, that we are sinful, and we're in need of a savior. That's offensive. That can hurt someone's feelings, but it is the truth that has to be shared. Again, I don't know how many doctors are going to say, oh, it's such good news when I tell someone they have appendicitis, when they have cancer, when their loved one is going to pass away, they need to say goodbye. That can hurt feelings. Does that make that false? When the doctor told me it's your appendix, you need surgery, and I went, oh, no, I don't want it. Did that make him wrong? Because he hurt my feelings? No, he's right. That's what was wrong with me. And my hurt feelings didn't make me the right one and make him wrong. Last one we won't spend much time in, but here we even have the Marxist worldview. 36% of practicing Christians embrace at least one aspect of Marxism, where private property is what encourages greed, not our sinful natures. And so if we just eliminate private property, if we have heavy taxation that just takes away people's stuff and make everyone equal, then our good human natures are going to come out and greed is going to be gone. And so a lot of people, 23% of young Christians under the age of 45, agree with this one. And I could keep going with these statistics. So I think what this is showing is that if we don't train our students and if we don't help our students think well, someone else will. If we're not talking about these issues, then they're learning from the culture. The culture is not lining up with the Christian worldview. The culture is not lining up with Christian ideas. And that's why we see only 17% of Christians, both young and old, actually have a biblical worldview. You can go to Summit's website and take the worldview test right here, and it'll tell you what percentage of a Christian worldview you have. But our students have to understand this. Now, how do we respond? As I mentioned before, I think that the loving thing to do is respond with truth, but in compassion. So I want to watch one more short video. This is a good friend of mine. I went to high school with him, and he kind of takes on this idea of this identity of how you can identify however you want society, takes it to its logical conclusion, and then says, well, now how do we respond? And so watch this short video.
There was recently a story about a 52-year-old father of seven who now self-identifies as a six-year-old girl. What do you think of that?
Man, I think it's interesting.
I've actually never heard of someone identifying as a different age.
I guess I shouldn't, you know, judge, you know, because everybody, you know, has their own, like, identity and stuff.
It's liberated me, and I don't have to act my age. And by not acting my age, I don't have to deal with the reality that was my past. I don't have to think about adult stuff. I still drink coffee and drive a car, right? Even my tractor, but I still drive the tractor as a little kid. I drive my car as a little kid.
Our culture is so unwilling to define boundaries, so afraid of being perceived as judgmental, that they won't even recognize simple traits like age, sex, or skin color as unchangeable.
If I were to say, I feel black, does that make me black?
Not necessarily, it doesn't.
I believe you just are what you are. I don't think you really become or be anything.
I don't think so, because that's a biological law. There should be a difference between mental state and biological appearance.
If a 65-pound woman came up to me and said, I'm fat, the kind, compassionate thing to do is to help her see herself in a way that conforms to reality.
So is there any limit to what somebody can self-identify as?
If you can find the resources to be the thing you want to be, you can do that.
We're not ready for that. We are just now becoming more aware of social issues in regards to how you identify.
If I identify as a 65-year-old, can I draw Social Security? If I say I feel like a Native American, do I qualify for Native scholarships? If I identify as a paraplegic, can I get one of those little handicap decals for my car? The real problem is that people don't want to deal with reality.
I was never allowed to be a little girl, so I'm filling that tank of little girl experiences. It's easy, it's innocent. It's like, just play. Everything becomes a game. Everything I imagined couldn't happen is happening.
That's a good statement to live by. Truth is compassion. Alan Schliemann, another speaker at Stand to Reason, when he deals with the topic of homosexuality and transgenderism, his approach is homosexuality, truth, and compassion. Right? There's a way that we can respond with the truth and be a jerk. But are we compassionate if we lie to the person, if we keep the truth from them? I don't think so. The loving thing to do is to help them see the truth. I think a good example was that Caleb brought up in that video. If a girl comes to you with anorexia, says, I'm fat, and she's 65 pounds, is it the loving thing to do? Says, yes, you are. Keep doing what you're doing. Is that the loving thing to do? No. The loving thing to do is to help her see herself in a way that matches reality. And that's what our students have to understand. The loving thing to do is to give the person the truth, to help them see themselves the way that matches reality in a way that is loving and compassionate. But if they have this idea that the moment you tell someone that they don't something they don't like, if that's unloving, if that's unwise, if that's bigoted, homophobic, judgmental, hypocritical, whatever you want to call it, then they're not going to be able to be the ones that stand up. It puts this fear in our students' minds of, I don't want to say anything that might upset someone. Because they live in this idea, the moment I upset someone, I'm wrong. Rather than how do we come alongside someone, help them see the way themselves the way that lines up with reality. Because we understand that a girl that's 65 pounds that thinks she's fat, that is that's destroying herself, right? That's hurting her. We have to come alongside and help her. And I think the same case can be made with transgenderism and with these different other social issues. So one way that I think that we really need, one step that we need to take with students is we need to not isolate our kids, we need to inoculate them. Now we all know what inoculation is, right? You give someone a little bit of a disease, and then that protects them from getting it fully. Now, back in the 1950s at Yale University, there was a professor there that had this idea that, you know, if inoculation works with sickness, what about with ideas? And so he did this experiment where he presented the people with the statement, you should brush your teeth every day. And then he came with a counter argument that brushing your teeth is bad for your health. And he had different test categories of which people fell for the false statement, brushing your teeth is bad, after telling them that brushing your teeth is good for you. So there's some people he gave no preparation. Other people he just said, he repeated the statement over and over again, brushing your teeth, you should brush your teeth every day, you should brush your teeth every day, you should brush your teeth every day. And then presenting them with this false statement, brushing your teeth is bad for you. Others, he warned them, you're going to be given a statement like brushing your teeth is bad for you. So I'm just warning you that this is going to be coming. And he had a few other different categories. What he found was what we see here. Jeff Myers, the president of Summit Ministries, is a youth apologetics worldview kind of summer program. He kind of looked and analyzed this study. And here's what he said. For people to believe a claim, they must be prepared to defend it against its challengers. Merely repeating the message over and over again, even with increasing fervency, emotion, clever staging, is actually counterproductive, worse than no preparation at all. This is what the professor at Yale University found. It's actually counterproductive to just repeat the same thing over and over and over again. Like most of us, we all went through high school. I remember my high school friends, I don't know how many times we were told, you shouldn't drink, 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 and my friends going out and drinking. Same thing with drugs. And I watch students and they just get the same message over and over and over again. I was speaking a little while back and I asked a student, I said, oh, you went to this one session, what'd you think about it? He goes, oh, it was a good session. I said, oh, what did you learn? He said, we just learned the list of don'ts. Don't drink, don't do drugs, don't have sex, and then you have a good life. It's just a list of don'ts. I think a lot of times we can just don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And we're not, I don't think, preparing them to really defend themselves against these arguments. So what is a way to do it? The antidote to indoctrination is to tell the truth, or step one. Expose people to the lies that would deceive them. Show them how to refute those lies, and then prepare them with the thinking skills necessary to continue resisting falsehood. There's a talk that I do. I just did it on Saturday for a youth camp down in Santa Clarita. It's called Atheist Roleplay. Sometimes the students know I'm role-playing. They know I'm a Christian and I'm a role-playing atheist. Other times the pastor invites me in and says, hey, this is my atheist friend. We want to have a dialogue. And so he introduces me as an atheist. The students think I'm an atheist. What I do in this talk is I spend 5 or 10 minutes and I go through the reasons why I'm not a Christian, the reasons why Christianity makes no sense. about 5-10 minutes. I open it up for about 30 minutes of questions. The students ask me, you know, things like, what do you think happens when you die? How do you explain the origin of life? How do you explain the origin of the universe? They try to give me apologetic arguments in defense of the existence of God, reliability of the New Testament. Why do you think the New Testament isn't true if there's all these miracles? And I can explain all of them away using atheistic arguments. What I found is that students are unable to respond to those questions. Oftentimes, they've never actually heard those arguments against Christianity. The first time I did it, when I got towards the end, the guys were angry at me, and a few of the girls were actually in tears. Because I had destroyed the foundation of Christianity in 30 minutes, something that their parents had spent 12, 13, 14 years building into them. After the 30 minutes, though, I revealed that I am a Christian. And then say, okay, now, what were some of the arguments that I presented that got you, that you didn't know how to respond to? Let's work through those. Let's look at how do you refute these. What were the true statements that I made? What were ways that I manipulated the information and lied? And helping them, because here's my thing. When I teach my high school students, I want the first time they hear these arguments to be with me, with someone that can walk through why this doesn't make sense. Why, you know, when I did the atheist role play, one of my arguments against Christianity is, look, your view of God is Trinity. That there's one person and three persons. That's a logical contradiction. Therefore, I don't need any evidence. Your God is obviously false. Because one God and one person, three persons, that can't be possible. I have yet to have a student tell me, sorry, that's actually a misdefinition of the Trinity. It's a straw man fallacy. I'm misdefining the Trinity to then knock it over and say, look, it's false. It's not one person and three persons. It's three persons and one being. There's a difference. But I've yet to have a student say, no, that's actually a misdefinition of the Trinity, just so you can knock it down. They haven't heard these arguments, and so the first time they hear it, and I respond, well, how do you explain the fine-tuning? And I say, well, if the universe is fine-tuned and God fine-tuned it, then God has to be even more finely tuned, making him even more unlikely. And they just go, ooh, I don't know, right? And they sit there. So I think this idea of inoculation, we tell them the truth of Christianity, then we expose them to the lies that would deceive them. They're going to hear this stuff in college. I want them to hear it for the first time with me, so then I can show them how to refute it, and then prepare them with thinking skills, that they understand the law of non-contradiction, the laws of logic, law of identity, that they understand logical fallacies, to where if you say things like, you know, I believe God exists, and they go, well, you're just closed-minded. Okay, but let's talk about the existence of God, not how open or closed-minded I am about it. It's an ad hominem, attack against the person rather than the argument. And I want to train my students to think well about these issues, so that the first time they hear it is not with a professor, away from my youth ministry, away from my high school classroom, away from whatever it is that I'm doing. And so they have already heard this. They know how to respond. Even if it's something that they haven't heard, I've given them the thinking skills to where they can process through it. They can ask those good questions and not be taken off guard. Now, one way, I'm here with Stand to Reason this morning, and one way that Stand to Reason helps students is by having the Rethink Apologetic Student Conference. This is every year, Southern California. There's also one in Dallas and another one in Alabama. But the one here in Southern California is going to be on September 22nd and 23rd. Last year, the topic was, who is Jesus? Realizing most students know the kind of the cliche answers of Jesus. Oh, he died on the cross for my sins. He's the Son of God. But when you get down to it, and when you start to ask in more detail, well, tell me more about that. How is Jesus both God and man at the same time? They don't know what to say. That was the topic last year. This year, the idea is going to be focused, looking at how worldview is influencing students. And so this is one awesome resource that Stand to Reason has. Last year, there were about 1,800 students at this conference in Southern California. So this is something to keep in mind. And then last, you can kind of stay connected with me, my ministry, Coffee House Questions, website, I have a podcast that I record every week. There's Facebook, there's Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, all these different ways for students to stay connected, for students to write in questions, for students to get short bits of information, whether it's short videos, whatever it may be, so that when they are on the college campus and they go, man, my professor just said this, I have no idea how to respond, that they have somewhere that they can go. So a lot of times maybe students, from what I hear, because I'm not a youth pastor, but a lot of times I hear students say, you know, I'm nervous to go to my youth pastor. Maybe they're going to think I'm doubting the faith. And maybe that they just need someone else. Rather than just Googling it and finding some other random answer on the internet, that they can have a source that they trust, something that's recommended. And so there's something for you guys to write down. So with that, we are out of time. But thank you guys for coming. I really appreciate it. And I'll be around the rest of today. And now if you guys have any questions. So thank you guys for coming. Have an awesome rest of your day.